All right, let's pick up where we left off tonight. We left off in the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 11. This is only 10 verses, so we probably it won't take us too long to get through this, hopefully, but I really didn't want to try to hit two chapters at once, because this chapter 12, I think it's kind of involved, even though that's somewhat short as far as the number of verses, too. But, you know, Solomon, again, I think he brings out a variety of different sayings or adages or maxims or proverbs that make a great deal of sense in terms of where the rubber meets the road as far as our everyday walk is concerned, our everyday life is concerned, where we live. You know, it's just basically putting wisdom into practice in a lot of ways that I think have a great deal of spiritual significance and, eternal value. Because remember, we're going through this book, Solomon says over 30 times, he talks about looking at life from the perspective of just the horizontal perspective and just the here and now, and just if all of life just simply amounts to the here and now, there's no afterlife, there's no God, well then everything is meaningless and pointless. Well, now he's coming around and he's basically incorporating the reality that, hey, you know, we can't just look at life from a horizontal perspective. We've got to look at it from a vertical perspective, that there is a God that we have to be accountable to. And so how are we going to live our lives in such a way that really is going to make a difference for eternity? And it begins with verse 1. It says, cast your bread upon the surface of the waters, and you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. Now, here's what I'm talking about as far as putting wisdom in to practice in terms of having it have not just practical value, but eternal value. Because, again, he now taking a look at life from this perspective of the here and now and saying, hey, it's nowhere, it's going nowhere, it's accomplishing nothing, it's a dead end, there's got to be more to it. So now he's coming in and he's giving some very solid advice of what to do with your life. And he says, cast your bread upon the surface of the water. Well, I think it's just kind of a slang, American slang. We talk, hey, do you have any dough? You got any bread? Well, you know what you're talking about. You're talking about your money, all right? Well, he's saying basically take your hard-earned money and cast it upon the waters. Now, we know from Revelations, we know from other portions of Scriptures that the waters represent what?
People.
People, nations, nationalities, tongues, tribes, kindreds. I mean, it just represents mankind. So, in other words, what he's saying is take your money and distribute it to the needy or those who are in need, or give to those who are less fortunate than you. This is what he's saying. Cast your bread upon the waters, and in due time it will come back to you. Well, you know, he's not talking about taking literal bread and throwing it upon the water so the duck could eat it or the fish could get it or whatever. He's making a metaphor here that I think makes a lot of sense, because if you cast bread on the water, it'll eventually go downstream, eventually go down the river, eventually go down into the sea. And then what's going to happen? He said it will come back to you. How? Well, we know this hydraulic system that God has designed and created as far as being able to water the earth. It's just all the water in the sea, the sun just hits it, of course, and then a great deal of it, billions of tons of water, is actually lifted up through this evaporation process. It forms all these clouds up there. It comes back, and eventually it comes back down in rain or snow, and it waters the earth. So what he's saying here is when you give of your hard-earned money to help other people, the less fortunate people, it's going to come back to you somehow. Remember what Jesus said? He said in the Gospel of Matthew, I believe it was. Also in Galatians, Paul talked about it in Galatians 6:10. He says, let us do good while we have opportunity, especially to those who are the household of the faith. So while we have these opportunities, we need to do good while they're there. I've said this so many times, and I believe it very strongly, that one of the greatest sins on Judgment Day that's going to loom the largest is the sins of omission. In other words, the opportunities that God has given us in this life to do good, to manifest our love for Him in positive ways, if we just waste these opportunities that are given to us, we're going to have to count to God for that. I mean, I can't imagine a people, and I could have said so many times, it always just amazes me that the statistics that bear out in this country where 56 hours a week are spent by the average person watching TV, well, I can't imagine that they're really making the most of the opportunities that God is making available to them. There's certainly nothing wrong with TV. I own TV and I watch TV, but the more I watch it, the less I watch it in a sense, because it's just wasting my time, so to speak. But I'm just simply saying this. Hey, while we have opportunity, let us do good to those, especially those of the household of the faith. And I think if there's an opportunity to do good and we ignore it, we neglect it, we do nothing about it, I think we're going to have to be accountable to God for it. And Jesus himself said in Matthew, he says, give and it will be given unto you. He said, it will be given unto you, pressed down, shaken together, running over. You know what he meant by that?
More than you can handle, more than you need.
Well, what does he mean by that? It will be given unto you, pressed down, shaken together, running over. What does he mean by that?
Taking a bag and shaking it down.
Right.
Where more, you can put more in.
Right. It's like back in Jesus, they used a bushel, for example, as you know, kind of a basket as a means of commerce. Well, when people would pour their grain into somebody's basket and they were going to buy some grain from them, they'd be pouring this grain in, they would shake the grain down so it would be packed together. Okay. It would be pressed down, and then it would be running over. Well, this is the analogy that Jesus used. If we would take our money and use it for his glory, for his honor, for the salvation of souls, the edification of the church, this is what we're commissioned to do. This is what Solomon is saying. Hey, cast your bread upon the waters, and in due time, it will come back to you. Eventually, it will. But that our motivation for giving of ourselves, our giving of our money, or our time, or our energy, or efforts, or whatever, the motivation has to be our love for God. Jesus himself said, look, if you even give a cold glass of water in my name, it will not lose its reward. In other words, God is not going to forget that. In the book of Hebrews, it tells us that God is not unjust so as to forget the love that we have shown towards his name in ministering and continuing to minister unto the saints. So this is the commission that God is giving to us, is to make the most of the opportunities that are available to us to minister to other people, especially to those of the household of the faith, to give to other people who are in need, if we are in a position to help them out. But also, like I said, it's not just simply money. It's not just simply monetary things we're talking about. We're talking about our time, our resources, our talents, whatever God has given to us. To cast your bread upon the waters could also mean, hey, get involved in your church. Start teaching a Bible study. Start teaching a Sunday school. Start using your talents to go to nursing homes, old folks' homes, wherever, to cast your bread upon the water there. And eventually, it'll come back to you. And then he says, verse 2, divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. The number 7 is the number of totality, the number of perfection, the number of completeness. So when he says to divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, in other words, it almost like even go above and beyond what is required of you sometimes in terms of helping other people and giving to other people. Because Jesus himself said, what you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me. And as far as he's concerned, this is the way he's going to evaluate us, on how we show our love for him by loving, you know, those around us. But that latter part of that verse 2, what does he mean when he says, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth? What's he saying?
Well, from a time when you don't have the opportunity to give.
Exactly.
When you may need someone.
Yeah, exactly. Both are applicable because it applies. When you have that opportunity, once it's gone, it may never return. When you have the resources and you don't do anything with it, you may never have another opportunity, or you may never have the resources again. Because what he's talking about here, divide your portion to 7 or even to 8, for you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. You don't know. You could apply this to death. You don't know when you're going to die, what misfortune may happen in your life. I remember at the beginning of this book, I had mentioned about there was a movie many years ago called something like A Short Time. And it was just about a guy who had been told by the doctors he got 2 weeks to live. And he actually got his medical records mixed up with somebody else's. And interesting thing, boy, that really revolutionized his life. It really turned it around. It really motivated him. It opened his eyes to see, hey, man, what am I doing with my life? I got 2 weeks to live. And he turned right around and he got his priorities right. I mean, he really began to pursue what really mattered in life in terms of his relationship with his wife and his relationship with his son and his relationship with other people. Everything else that he thought was so important in life, all of a sudden it got placed on a back burner because he thought, hey man, I only got 2 weeks to live. And of course it revolutionized his whole life and changed everything around. And then he finds out 2 weeks later, well, the medical records were mixed up. But it was that realization that, hey man, I don't have much time left. What am I going to do with it? And that's what I think he's talking about here in that verse 2 when he says, you do not know what misfortune may occur to you on the earth. So you better make the most of the opportunity that God has given you at this point. And then he says in verse 3, he says, if the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. And whether a tree falls towards the south or towards the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. Now, let's just back up for a second because in that verse 3 it says, if the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth. Well, I think what he's referring to here or kind of alluding to is the fact that certain things take a natural course in life, all right? Certain things are going to happen. In other words, if the clouds are full, they are designed to release their water upon the earth. Well, let's just say if your pockets are full, well, you should do the same thing in terms of helping other people. And I mentioned this before about you look at so many people who, in history, who have had so much going for them in terms of monetary blessings. I mean, I think of like Howard Hughes. Here was a guy who was a multimillionaire, probably a billionaire, one of the richest men on the face of the earth during his lifetime. And you look how he lived his life. I mean, it was an utter total waste. At the end of his life, the guy was basically insane. I mean, he was just he never showered, never took a bath. He had a phobia about germs and bugs, and he let his nails grow and his hair grow, and he was just a total mess. And of course, after he died, where did all his money go? It was divided up between all the lawyers, and that was the end of that. I mean, and where is he tonight when he had so much going for him as far as resources? And where is he? And you know what? I don't really want to go down this road, but I can't help but think of, I look at a lot of these people who are in our government running our, the politicians, and it always amazes me, the one particular party in particular that always is crying about how we need to help the poor. You know, and you look at these people who are the multi-millionaires, especially this one guy who ran for president last time. You know, he's just filthy rich because he married into a lot of money. But then when the media wanted to know how much taxes he paid and how much money he gave to charities, it's virtually nothing. Virtually nothing. But these are the same people who are constantly hounding the rest of us to cough up more and more tax money so they can throw it around to what they consider to be needy people. I mean, to me, that is so hypocritical, and that is so corrupt, and that is so unjust, and is so phony. It's like, hey man, why don't you take your own money and give it away instead of taking more of my money and giving it away, since you want to be so charitable. And like I said, I didn't want to go down that road, but you look around you and it's just all over the turf as far as people who have the money. You know, very often they're the ones who are the least charitable. Statistics have borne this out time and time again, where the people who are the most generous are the people who are low, medium income. And it's not the high-income people. It's always the middle class and the lower middle class people who, percentage-wise, give most of their money to charity. I just thought it out there because I'm just saying that if we're looking at what it's saying here, it's saying if the clouds are full, the natural order of things is today to release their rain. All right. Well, if God has given us blessings, then we need to share it with other people. Unfortunately, a lot of the people who have most money, they're the ones who are the biggest misers on the face of the earth. They're going to have to account for it. I'm not trying to be their judge. I'm just simply saying, hey, man, he who has been given much is going to be required of him. And then he says here in that latter part, it says, verse 3 says, if the clouds are full, they pour out the rain upon the earth, and whether a tree falls towards the south or towards the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. Now, this is one of these statements that you look at it and you think, well, that was a real ingenious statement. It reminded me of that statement of, you ever hear of Oliver's Law of Location? He says, wherever you go, there you are. And you think, oh, wow, this guy's a real genius. You know, wherever you go, there you are. But then, you know, you look at it a little bit deeper and you say, well, you know what? If you take us on a spiritual plane, wherever you go, there you are, in this sense, that where is our walk taking us, spiritually speaking? It is so important because the Bible talks over and over and over again about our walk. If you look in a concordance, you look at the word walk, I mean, it is literally hundreds of times you will find that word that is used throughout the scriptures. And walk, it denotes making progress in a definite direction. And I'm telling you, we are all going in a definite direction. We're not going all going in the same direction, that's for sure. But we are all going in one direction or another. And so when he's talking about here, as far as the tree, he says, whether a tree falls to the south or towards the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. So in other words, you can make two applications from this, actually more, but the two applications are this. When a tree falls, in other words, there's certain things in life that are going to happen that you have no control over, for one thing, and you just got to accept things the way they are. All right? And the other application, of course, is the fate that our ultimate fate is basically going to be unchanged in terms of what we decide we're going to do with our life now. I mean, that's where the tree falls. That's where it's going to lie. I mean, if you are headed in the direction of hell, unless there's a change of heart, a repentance, and a turnaround, that's where it's going to lie. That's where there's going to be no changing that. There's going to, you know, once you're there, that's the end of it. Same thing with heaven. And then it says here in that verse 4, it says, he who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. You know what? If you read that verse 4, but then go down to verse 6, because read the 4 and 6 together. It says, he who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Sow your seed in the morning, and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether the morning or evening sowing will succeed, or whether the both of them alike will be good. And Jesus, you know, in Matthew 13, he gave the parable of the sower and seed. You know, he said that the sower went out to sow a seed. He says some seed, it fell on the roadside. And some seed fell on rocky places. And some seed fell among thistles and thorns. And then he said some seed fell upon, you know, good soil. And then when the apostles asked him what all that meant, and he interpreted it, he said that the seed that fell upon the roadside, he said the birds came and ate it up, and the birds represented Satan. And he said the seed that fell on rocky places, he said that they had no depth to them, so they, in a sense, when they received the word of God, they received it with joy and enthusiasm, but there was no depth to them, so when persecution came or the sunrise, then it burned up. All right, and then he also said it's a seed that was thrown among thistles and thorns that represented the cares and the worries of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and a person's spiritual life can be choked out by these things of the world. And then, of course, he talked about the good seed that fell upon the good soil, and it in turn produced 160 and 30-fold. Well, if you read this about sowing your seed, don't just make the application in terms of the literal, because the Bible always makes a parallel, a spiritual parallel in regards to the physical realities of our life. And I think sometimes I look back on some of the people that I've sown seed in terms of not being up to it, not feeling like it, or not feeling very optimistic in terms of them being receptive to the gospel. I remember years ago, I don't know, Keith Lane might remember, Carol Hale? His name was Carol. He was a guy I worked with.
He was an older man?
Yeah, he was an older guy that I worked with. He used to work night crew, and then he finally got on days. And I don't know, he was in his 50s or 60s or whatever, but he was a real BSer. He just liked to chat. He just liked to just talk. He was just a real talker. And I spent so much time witnessing to him, and I witnessed him, and I was getting nowhere. And I thought, I'm just wasting my time with this guy because he's just a talker. He was a nice guy, a likable guy, but I didn't ever feel like he would ever, well, this seed would ever take hold in his heart. And lo and behold, one night he came to Bible study, and then he started coming to Bible study on a regular basis. And then, of all people, guess who he brought? He brought Dick Wharton. And Dick Wharton ended up accepting Christ through the Bible study. And Dick Wharton, as you know, even though he's in a wheelchair, he's out there every day witnessing and ministering to people. But he came to the Lord through the Bible study, but it was Carol Hale that brought him to the Bible study. And I had given up on this Carol Hale, thinking, well, I'm just wasting my time with him. But he did backslide for a little bit, but then he came back. And then he was a smoker. I mean, he smoked all his life, and he was a chain smoker. And then he ended up coming down with cancer. But I remember that when he was dying in the hospital, I went in to see him. He was in critical care, and he couldn't really talk because he had tubes down his throat and everything. But I took his hand, and I said, Carol, would you want to pray with me? And he just nodded. And I just prayed the sinner's prayer again with him and prayed over him, and the next day he died. And, I think to myself, well, here's a man that... I kind of wrote off, this seed is not going to take root in the guy's heart, but it did. And there's other people, I will sow my seed, and I'm thinking, hey man, this person's really going to get on fire for the Lord, and I just have a great deal of expectation, and it gets nowhere. Some of the people that I think aren't going to accept the Lord, they accept the Lord and they make a difference. Other people I think they're definitely going to accept them, they still dilly-dallying around. And with their lives. It's not up to me to make the decision. It's up to me to just simply keep planting your seed. Because what does he say here now? Verse 6, sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening, for you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. So when the opportunity comes, just take the most of the opportunity. I remember as a real young Christian in the Lord, I had led a guy by the name of Phil Lumel, who I worked with, had led him to the Lord. And he got pretty enthusiastic about the things of the Bible. And then he asked me one day, he says, there's a friend of mine I'd like you to witness to. And, I says, okay, well, give me a call tonight and let me know when you want me to come over. But I remember I was really, really kind of down. I was kind of depressed, and I was kind of sick. I mean, physically, I just felt really, really lousy. And I remember just crawling into bed, and I was thinking to myself, oh, I just hope he doesn't call, because I am not up to this at all. And just as I started to doze off to sleep, he called. And so he says, hey, yeah, my friend's coming over. You want to come over and witness to him? And, I just thought, oh, gosh, I'm just not up to this. I just don't want to do this. And I thought, well, okay, I'll be there. So I hung up the phone, and I dragged myself out of bed, and I dragged myself over there, and I was so tired, so exhausted. I was just feeling really, really lousy, and I think the devil was doing a real number on me. And I get over there, and you know what it is? It's Mark Toga. And of course, this is the first time I met the guy. And I spent the evening witnessing to him, and he ends up accepting the Lord, and he's still walking with the Lord today. So it's kind of like, hey, man, just you never know. If the opportunity is there, just take advantage of it. And like I said, there's some people, especially at work, I'll give a tape to, or I'll even give a copy of one of my manuscripts to or something, and then it's like you never hear from them again. And I just feel like, gosh, I just feel frustrated because I just feel like they run off with my tape, or they run off, and it didn't do any good. It's like, hey, that seed was pretty precious, I want to sow it somewhere else if you're not going to do anything with it. But I got to leave it in the God's hands and just say, okay, well, I just keep sowing my seed. And what is it Paul tells us? He says, preach the word in season and out season. In other words, whether you feel like it or whether you don't feel like it, you got to keep preaching the word. But let me make this clarification too. Jesus did say, hey, don't give what is holy to dogs. Don't throw your pearls to swine, because they'll turn on you. So you have to use some discernment. I mean, I don't go around witness to every person I meet, okay? I pray for an opportunity. If the opportunity avails itself, then I really do try to take advantage of it and make the most of it. But there's certain people I just feel like, hey, I'm not even going to bother with this person because they are just hostile and they're going to take offense. And I don't, you know, I don't need that. I don't need that. But if I get along with them and the opportunity is there, I will take advantage of it. But if I see somebody that's just really hostile towards the gospel, I just kind of back off. I think, well, you know, I'm not going to throw my pearls to swine here. I'm not going to go to the dog because I don't need this kind of headache. But I still pray for them. I still pray for an opportunity that maybe someday I will have that their heart will be ready, that they will be prepared to listen to it. Anyway, he also says in that verse 4, because I kind of jumped down from 3 to 6, it says that he who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks to the clouds will not reap, just as you do not know the path of the wind and how bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. So if you tie together 4 and 6 and then you look at 5 in between, basically it's saying this, okay, especially if when you apply it spiritually to witnessing to other people, it's like God is the one who really gives the growth. He's the one that gives the life. He's the one that gives the increase. We just have to be faithful in sowing the seed, all right? Sowing the seed of the gospel, and then leave it into his hands. Because, like I said, I've been around long enough to see that, hey, man, sometimes the people you least expect come around, and the people you most expect, they're still dilly-dallying in the tulip somewhere. And this is in verse 7. It says, the light is pleasant, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Now, he just makes a statement here. You know, if you take 7 and 8 together, and actually you probably should read the rest of it together. Let me just read the rest of it because it actually all ties in together, even though he's saying different things, but it all has a common theme if you put it all together. So read 7 through 10. It says, the light is pleasant and is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all. Let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Everything that is to come will be fertility. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood. Let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. So remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. Okay, this is the conclusion of chapter 11, but if you kind of take this, all of these concluding verses 7, 8, 9, and 10 together, there's a theme in it. It says, the light is pleasant and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Well, there's many applications to that, all right? But you tie it in with what the rest of it that he's saying, that he's telling us here. It's like, okay, you're going to have, a light is can also be synonymous or parallel with the good times, the good days, the joyful times, the joyful experiences, the pleasant times, okay, because he also makes a reference in the following verse to darkness, which we all know could mean the bad times, the difficult times, the times of suffering and sorrow and heartbreak and disillusionment and this type of thing. So when he says here, the light is pleasant and it's good for the eyes to see the sun, well, you tie that together, all right? It's if you just take it in and of itself, sure, it's a statement that just makes a lot of sense, because without light, we can see nothing. I mean, you can have 20/20 eyesight, and without light, where are you going to go? You can't move. I mean, you are just stuck. I'll never forget that time I was playing this game. It's called Murder. You know, it was many, many years ago, like 20 years ago, and we were playing in this cabin, and everybody turned out the lights. And, of course, I wasn't really into the game, you know, but I just felt like, oh, I just want to be left alone. I remember I crawled under the stairwell, and it was just pitch dark. You couldn't see a thing. And I remember this guy who, I think it was Mike Herp, he was crawling towards me, and I could hear somebody crawling towards me, but I couldn't see him. And he got up to this close to my face because I could feel him breathing in my face, and I was just holding my breath, and he was looking right at me, but he couldn't see me. And then he turns around, and I could hear him crawling away. I mean, and he got 20/20 eyesight, but he couldn't see me. So in other words, light is essential, all right, not just in the physical world, but apply this spiritually, because Jesus made the statement about light. He made it in the Gospels, where he said that if the light that is in you is darkness, he said, how great is that darkness? And I have really, really come to appreciate what Jesus said there, because he's talking about so many people who feel like they are enlightened, who feel like they know the truth. I don't care whether they're New Agers. I don't care whether they're in cults. I don't care whether they're into UFOs or whatever. You know,
evolutionists,
good. You know, a lot of these college professors, they think that they have the answer. So that's the light that's in them. But Jesus said, if the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? You can hardly penetrate it with the real light, because these people are closed off to the truth, to the real light, because they feel like the light I have is the right light. But Jesus said, if that light is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? That's why it's very, very difficult for me, for example, to try to get a person who is in a cult to see the truth. Because the light that's in them is darkness. And Jesus said, how great is that darkness? And it's just, you know, so difficult to get that person to have their eyes open. Because it's kind of like they have a mindset that says, hey, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. And I don't care whether they're evolutionists. I don't care whether they're cultists. I don't care whether they're New Agers. I don't care whether they're into UFOs or whatever. It's kind of like their mind is made up, so don't confuse me with the facts. So that's the light that's in them, and it's darkness. So, and also he says in that verse 8, he says, indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all. Let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. Everything that is to come will be futility. Now, here is another statement that on the surface, it doesn't seem like there's is that profound. But again, if you take it in the light of just living, if you look at it from a perspective of the grave, if you look at it from a perspective that, hey, man, everything in this world is just temporary, then it kind of thinks, I think it helps us focus in on what's really important, because he says, indeed, if a man should live many years, let him rejoice in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness. Well, he says that the days of darkness are going to be many. Right? We're living in a fallen world, we have fallen natures, and let's face it, I read somewhere, I forget where it was, but to me it's so true. It basically, what I read is that they have kind of like calculated that a person can hardly go 2 weeks in their life without coming down with some kind of illness or sickness or having some kind of unexpected difficulty or financial problem or something. All right, just something unexpected to come up and slap them upside the head with another problem. All right. And I don't even think you can go a week, but this one says you can't go 2 weeks without something happening, all right, where it's just going to add more grief to your life, more stress, more anxiety, more anxiousness to your everyday living. I mean, and I think, well, it's very true, because we are living in a fallen world. So when he says the days of darkness are going to be many, well, he's also saying, hey, at the same token, put everything in perspective. Because what does he tell us further down? He says, verse 9, rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things, so remove vexation from your heart. What's vexation?
Annoyance.
Yeah, it's annoyance, it's irritation, it's being angry or upset or seething inside. He says, remove vexation from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. So you put all this together, and I think he's making a lot of sense here. In other words, we're going to have a life full of problems and full of difficulties and full of struggles and whatnot, but we have to put everything in its proper perspective. So he says, put vexation from your heart, put it away from you. Vexation is, like I said, it's anger, it's annoyance, it's irritation. Let's just put it this way. We're living in a world where, in our relationships with so many people, I don't care if it's on our job or in our marriage or in other kind of relationships, I mean, there can be an awful lot of built-up resentment bitterness, hostility, hatred, whatever. Well, Bible's saying, hey, do your utmost to put this away from your heart. Because for one thing, it really is wreaking havoc with your immune system, with your health. Another thing is like, hey, these things don't make mountains out of molehills. Sometimes it's much better off to let things slide and just simply enjoy life rather than letting someone else or some other group of people make your life miserable. In other words, sometimes it really does. It's really wise advice to let a lot of stuff just slide off your back and just keep going on with almost sublime indifference and just saying, hey, man, I ain't got time to be angry and annoyed and irritated over this type of stuff because it's just not worth it. You almost got to choose your battles, okay? Because if you don't, your life is going to be ebbing away with so much irritation and vexation and frustration and annoyance, and you're not going to enjoy your life. I mean, I remember there was a guy I used to work with many, many years ago. I mean, I just developed a real hatred towards him. I mean, there was a real vexation in my heart, my spirit towards this guy. I mean, I could hardly even look at him or hear his voice over the intercom without feeling annoyance, irritation, just constant irritation. I mean, I got to the point where I literally just hated the guy. And I look back on that and I think, you know what? I really became his slave because I could hardly sit down and enjoy a meal without seeing his ugly face in front of me. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, well, I don't want to say ruining my life, but it certainly was sapping me of joy in my life. But eventually, you know, God just enabled me to see the foolishness and the sinfulness and the wickedness in my own heart by holding such a, you know, contempt towards this other human being. And I was able to forgive him. And, hey, man, and I went on with my life. And to this day, if I run into him, I could look at him as an old friend. I honestly can, because it's happened to me before. And it's kind of like, hey, when you hate a man, you become his slave. You really do. And sometimes, you know, we just have to let things go and you got to choose your battles. And when you do, if you can let it go, he says, hey, put vexation from you, from your heart, and put away pain from your body. Because I'm telling you, it's interesting. Vexation, anger, resentment, bitterness, envy, these type of things, they have been proven over and over and over again to wreak havoc with your physical body, with your health. They will. It increases your blood pressure. It just completely ruins you physically. If you can't forgive somebody, if you have such contempt and such malice for another person, it wreaks havoc with your body. And then he says, put these things away because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. So in other words, hey, you know, especially when you're young, enjoy your life. But he's also giving a caution here. He's put these ironclad safeguards that simply says in that verse 9, rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you into judgment for all these things. So in other words, he's saying, hey, make the most of your life, especially when you're young, when you can enjoy life the most. When you're young, the last thing you want to do is just be so stressed and bummed out and depressed. I mean, but unfortunately, look what's happening today. Suicide is the number two cause of death among young people, among adolescents and teenagers and young adults. And you wonder, well, why are so many young people taking their lives? Well, because they got their focus right. And sometimes, you know, believe it or not, when you're young and you're dumb, I mean, some things that are really totally insignificant, you may feel at the time that this is the worst thing that you could possibly imagine happening to you. I mean, I've heard and read about a situation where, you know, a kid will take his life because he didn't get a 4.0 on his report card. I mean, you know, that to me is, you know, really missing you know, the whole point to your existence. And then, you know, a lot of these poor kids, they take their lives for one reason or another. I don't care whether it's because of their love life or whatever, or they feel rejected, or, you know, one kid I read about took his life because he didn't like his looks. I mean, it's a shame. It's really a shame, because when you're that young, you're very vulnerable to a lot of influences, and your emotions are, you know, in, well, they're in a real uproar, and it's very difficult sometimes to see things clearly. Because sometimes all you need is a good night's sleep, and you can see things in a different perspective. But this is what I think we need to do when we're looking at life. We really have to look at life from a different perspective than simply the horizontal, simply the here and now. We have to always look at life from the perspective that, hey, there's a God that we need to be accountable to. And that must be our ultimate focus, because that's what he's saying here. Enjoy your life. Do what you want in life. You know, make the most of your life. Really have a lot of fun in your life. But remember that God must be your focus, and you're going to have to account to God. So it's kind of like God wants us to enjoy life. He really wants us to find pleasure in life. I mean, to me, you know, I'm the kind of guy that I really don't get a lot of enjoyment out of, let's say, going to a party or going to, you know, I hate going to a place like Disneyland. I absolutely hate it. I just hate it. I'm not kidding you. I mean, I feel like it ought to be free to get in and pay $200 to get out, man. Just because it's just like, oh man, get me out of this place. But people think, boy, I'm just really weird, and maybe I am, because I just don't find enjoyment in that kind of thing, standing in one line after another for 45 minutes for a 2-minute thrill ride. I mean, I just don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, when there's a crowd, I like to just go the other way. But the thing is, you know, I think God impressed upon me how God enjoys seeing us get pleasure out of his creation. And I think he pressed this upon me in a very deep way when Rachel was just about 2 years old. Because I remember buying her and Caleb a root beer. And I gave them the root beer. And I always remember Rachel sipping this root beer. And she never had a root beer before. It had a very distinctive taste to it. And she just kept saying over and over again, "Daddy, I like this Coke, Daddy. I like this Coke. I like this Coke." And she just kept, and I got a lot of pleasure out of just her enjoyment out of that Coke. I mean, and it was a root beer. And I just really, I got a lot of pleasure out of that. Now, if she had taken that root beer and just poured it all over the carpet, I would have been ticked off. You know what I'm saying? I mean, because, you know, a total misuse of what it was intended for. Here's the same thing with God. He gets a lot of pleasure out of our enjoyment of his creation, of the things that he's made for us. That's why I can hardly ever take a cold glass of water without, with every swallow, just thanking him for this simple pleasure in life. Because what would life be without it? There's hardly a day goes by, and including today, that I haven't thanked God for my eyesight. You know, because to me it's just a marvel. I just really, really am grateful for such a marvelous gift. It's these things that we take so much for granted. These are the things we really need to focus in on and enjoy, I really think. And I think that it gives God a great deal of pleasure and a great deal of glory when we can find pleasure in life and enjoy it the way he intended it. Now, of course, the devil has never been able to create one pleasure. He hasn't been able to create one taste bud. He's never been able to create one thing at all that's going to, you know, give our life in the slightest bit of a pleasure. All right. The only thing he can do is try to pervert the things that God has given us in life for pleasure, and to get us to misuse them so that we, you know, offend God. See, that's his whole game, because he can't create a pleasure. All right. Is God has created all the pleasures in life, and he says, okay, these pleasures I've given you, I want you to enjoy them. But they all have a time and a place and a purpose. And if you enjoy them in the way that I intended you to, I get a lot of pleasure out of that. Okay? If you misuse them, then obviously it offends him. So that's what, you know, you just take this for what it's saying here. The last two verses. Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of your young manhood, and follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes. Yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. So remove vexation or anger or irritation or annoyance from your heart and put away pain from your body. To put away pain from your body, sometimes that's impossible to do, right? I look at Gail and she's... right now she's in bed, she's in pain, she came home, she was in pain last night, she was crying, and sometimes she just almost despairs, you know, and it really kind of brings me down because of her illness. But I think sometimes, okay, even in the midst of your pain, sometimes you can't put the pain away from you, but you have to take another look at your pain and saying, okay, what can I do in my pain and how can I, you know, utilize this pain? In other words, I look at a person like Johnny Erickson, okay, you know, she's been a paraplegic for, you know, what, 30 years or something? I don't know how long, but in spite of her pain, she kind of like has put it aside and goes out there and even because of her pain, you know, she glorifies God. She's using what she has. In other words, even in sickness, we can still glorify God. We can still, if we have our focus right, we can still find a lot of enjoyment in life if we're just willing to just get our eyes off of ourselves and get our eyes on Him. And then I think we can put away pain from our body and put our focus where it belongs. That's what he's talking about here. Anybody have anything you want to add or share what we read tonight? Well, let's move it to next week. We're going to conclude this book, and I think that then starting after we finish this book, we're going to go back. We're going to read the book of Ruth. I think it's only like four chapters, and my intention is to tackle as many of the smaller books in the Old Testament as we can, just simply so I can get as many books as I can on the internet, so Kevin can get as many on there. Before, you know, the Lord calls us home. I mean, I think our ultimate goal is to be able to get the whole Bible on the internet, which would be good if we can do it. But if we don't have enough time, I want to get as many books as we can. Anybody have anything to add or share?
Did you give a revelation about what was happening? It's coming fast.
What do you mean?
You said you got to get them on there fast.
Well, you know, we decided to do this over 5 years ago, right, Kevin?
Do what?
We've been putting this stuff on the internet for over 5 years, right?
I think it was October 97 that we started. When did your dad get cancer?
Wow.
Well, that's when we started.
Okay, well, that's...
This is 97 or 98.
Okay. Well, so it's about 6 years or whatever. What I'm saying is that...
It's going on eight, I think.
Yeah. Oh, eight?
Yeah.
7 or 8 years.
Really? Well, see, yeah. Kevin and I, we thought, well, we're running out of time. We'd like to get this on the internet, but I said, well, let's do this. Let's get the Book of Revelation on the internet. I said that'll be our first goal. If we could just get that, we'll have something to leave that people will have something to read if they're left behind. Okay, that they have the Book of Revelation. Well,
and that was 5 years ago. We did the Book of Revelation.
Was
wow.
it
5 years?
Time flies.
Okay, well, I thought the Revelation was the first book we put up on the internet. I guess
the first book was Zechariah.
Okay, then we were probably going through
the minor prophets when we started that.
Okay, all right. Well, anyway, we got the entire New Testament on the internet except for two Gospels, and we've got I know we got all the minor prophets on there. That's 12, and then we got we're finishing up Ecclesiastes. We got the Song of Songs. We got Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus on there. We got, and I think one or two other. Anyway, we're slowly getting there. You know, it may take us another 10 years, but like I said, we didn't think we had any time left when we started, and we've been doing it for
seven. Chapter a week. It's about another 17 years.
Well, you know what? I'm actually going to try to, you know, start picking up the pace here. Well,
oh, great.
Okay. No.
Bad news.
Okay, like when you go through the Psalms is 150 chapters.
Yeah.
But there are a number of Psalms that you could probably go through three or four or five of them in a night because they're pretty short. But then you get to a Psalm like 119 and it's like, hey, that's going to go on forever.
And you know, it's not about once you start getting the books like... Isaiah's not on there. And
right.
Jeremiah's not on there.
Right. And Ezekiel.
Numbers, these long books. Go through Psalms that way. Do two chapters of Numbers and then do a Psalm. Do another two chapters of Numbers, do a Psalm. And we'll just work in Psalms, you know, something to lighten things up a little bit. The heavier books. That was a thought of mine. You think?
Okay, we could do that. Yeah. All right, well, let's just close with a prayer. Lord, we just look to you in prayer right now. We just like to just thank you for the opportunity you've given us to read your word tonight, and even though we are a small group and